Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, hear from Sarah Wheeler, whose adventures have taken her to some of the most exciting and far-flung places on the planet, and award-winning journalist and best-selling author, Christina Lamb, one of Britain's leading foreign correspondents. Recorded live at the 2023 Bradford Literature Festival, join us to explore their remarkable lives and the challenges and rewards of working as trailblazing women in two notoriously male-dominated fields.
Am I right in thinking this is not the first time that you two have been on a panel together? The last time was 29 years ago.
I believe that piece of information has been on Earth somewhere or other, yes. But it's jolly nice to be here next to Christina again.
It's wonderful to have you back together after all these years.
And of course, we were incredibly young 29 years ago.
So, let's wind the clock back a bit. Can you tell us a bit about what it was like starting out in your respective professions and what sort of drove you to up sticks and head out into the great unknown?
So I grew up in a very uninteresting suburb of South London and spent all my time in the library reading books, and I think that made me realise that there was a big wide world out there. And so I always wanted to travel and always wanted to write. Actually, I never really thought about being a journalist. I wanted to be a novelist, maybe partly because I'd never met a journalist. And then when I was at university, a friend was going to a cheese and wine party and said to me, why don't you come? And of course, free cheese and wine as a student was very attractive. So I went to this party, and it was for the university newspaper. And so the editor and different section editors were talking about what they did. And I thought, actually, I really like writing, and I'm very curious. My mom would say that I'm nosy. And so I thought I'd like to do that. So I joined the university paper, actually ended up editing it. And so when I left university, I got an internship at the Financial Times for the summer, which was just for 2 weeks, but then I was able to keep extending it because people were on holiday. And then, to me, the foreign correspondence at the Financial Times, which at that point had more foreign correspondents than I think any other newspaper, were incredibly glamorous and exciting. They sort of arrived back. They were known as the Camel Corps, and they came into the office with these sort of satchels full of foreign newspapers. They were, of course, all male. And so I thought that's what I want to be. And basically, as it's a long story, but as you mentioned in the introduction, I ended up getting invited to a wedding in Karachi, which was not an ordinary wedding because it was Benazir Bhutto's wedding. And it was an incredible introduction to Pakistan. And I met all these people who were basically risking their lives to try and take on Pakistan's military dictator, General Zia, and had told me about how they'd been tortured and tear-gassed and arrested. And at that point, I was working at Central TV in Birmingham as a training reporter covering local news, and I just thought, this is much more exciting than anything that I'm writing about or covering in Birmingham. So I came back and gave him my notice and went to live in Pakistan. So that's how I started.
Well, I grew up in a working class environment in Bristol, and everybody was blue collar Tories, and the Daily Express was the only newspaper that I had ever seen in our flat. And I think it inspired me with an overpowering feeling to get away, which has never left me, actually. And it was a very homogenous background, you know, everybody was like us. And anybody who wasn't like us, we were very deeply suspicious of them. I'm not talking about people with different colour skins, because there weren't any of those. I'm talking about Catholics. That was about as exotic as impinged on the imagination. And I was a grammar school girl, so that gave me the most tremendous education that, and I think that I had the best state-funded education any girl has ever had.
That's funny, I'm a grammar school girl.
And I really am so grateful to that. And of course, when you have children of your own, you want them to have the same thing as you had, don't you, if it was that good, but it didn't exist anymore. Anyway, so I wanted to get away from there. I wanted to be a writer, and it seemed to me that travel was the perfect vehicle to write about other things. You know, it's a metaphor of a vehicle of smuggling stuff in. And, I mean, Christine, as a foreign correspondent, writes everything she writes about is unimportant, is really important, and everything I write about is really unimportant. And the only justification I can make for that really is that maybe it shines some tiny light on what it is to be human. And I just haven't got the, I mean, and I find that in looking at what I was brought up to believe to be the other, I think maybe it defangs it when you are among the other and you see that the other isn't the other. We are all the other. And I continued setting my writing, anything I wanted to write, in foreign land because I found it the most fertile territory. And so I went on doing that for many decades. And I'm the opposite of an academic in that I'm a generalist, which is very unfashionable, but someone has to be one. So I like to believe someone has to be one. Every book somewhere new and so on. And this last book I've done, which was a sort of memoir of a woman's life on the road, I took down all my notebooks. They were there like soldiers, you know, on my office on the wall with the Tippex countries on the spine. And absolutely astonishing how much I'd forgotten. And why had I left the best bits out and all kinds of stuff like that. And so it was great pathos. And about this, you know, everything I write about is unimportant. It's the sort of granular detail of humanity. I think that maybe as a foreign correspondent, foreign news, there is a place where those two things join. I remember, for example, Christina wrote this book in 2002, I think it was, Sewing Circles of Herat. And you say at the beginning, I think it is, that I never forget the line you wrote about being so deeply involved with all these people. And then you say, but then I was going to be back soon and I would have forgotten all of, and I'd be away from all of this and I would be sad. And that sort of, it's like a musical overture of coming and going and constant leaving and the emotional upheaval of life on the road. I'm trying to draw comparisons between what we do, which seems a very different, but I think at some granular level. And I do think that there's something specific about a woman's voice in these instances. And that coming and going and the being sad wherever you are, because that's how it is sometimes. You're sad wherever you are. You're not there and you're not here. And I got that very much from that book on Afghanistan, Sewing Circles of Herat. It was 2002, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And the loneliness of the hotel room. Maybe it, when you're with the press corps, it's different, but I'm always on my own. And, you know, I know a lot about being in hotel rooms on your own at night, which actually we don't tend to write about very much. Loneliness. And I have an attenuated sense now of always being in the other place. And I think that's maybe the price one pays for the great advantages of life on the road. I can't remember what your question even was, but I feel sure I've strayed so far away from it by now that it must like give you a chance to ask another one.
So, Christina, as you mentioned, your profession and travel writing as well is very male dominated, and I'd like to know a bit about, you know, like now you both are inspirations for women coming through into the field that you both work in. I wonder what your inspirations and what your role models were when you were sort of starting out.
I mean, I think I didn't think about it very much that there weren't many women doing what I did when I went, because I just went, as I described. And I started, I actually, the first thing I covered was the war in Afghanistan under the Soviet occupation. And so I was living in Peshawar and traveling back and forth into Afghanistan with the Afghan Mujahideen. And there were very few other women doing it. But because, I don't know, although you were talking about sort of loneliness in the press corps, I've always pretty much worked for weekly papers, and I've never really hung out very much with the other journalists. I've always kind of gone and done my own thing, because I'm much more, if you just stay with the other journalists, you end up kind of just talking to them all the time rather than actually the people that you're supposed to be covering. And so I think at the beginning I wasn't so aware of it, but what, and also because it was a different time and there was no internet, there were no mobile phones, it was like I was reporting into a black hole. I just sent these stories by telex, and I used to have to go to the telex operator and bribe the telex operator to send this thing. So I'm sure there are people here who are too young to remember these things. Or I dictated to copy over the phone, which was awful because I wrote quite long stories, and sometimes it was work writing for like the Sunday Times then, which was owned by the same people as The Sun. And so they were used to quite short stories, and I'd be dictating and the copy taker would say, "Is there much more of this?" Which is very kind of demoralizing. So it wasn't like I was seeing what other people did. It was really different. So you really only just did your own thing, your own reporting. But I was always, right from the start, really interested in what happened to women in war. So I basically became a war correspondent by accident. I didn't set out to cover war. I didn't have some great interest. I hate war, actually. I wish all these wars would end. But unfortunately, we don't seem very good at ending wars anymore. So they all go on forever. And I'm very fascinated in how people live during a war. So, you know, even I just came back from Ukraine. There are millions of people in Ukraine still going to work, going to restaurants, going on dates, getting married. I saw a wedding in Dnipro just a couple of weeks ago, trying to bring up their children, look after the elderly, all while the war is going on. And that's the same, you know, in Syria, in Libya, in Central African Republic, all these places where there are wars. And that's really interesting to me, much more interesting than the actual fighting. And so usually the people who are doing all those things are the women. So I've always talked much more to the women in war. And we can get into that maybe later, but because of that, I've also been very aware of the dark side of what happens to women in war. And it didn't occur to me for a very long time that I was doing something different to anybody else. And I never came back and lived in England and worked as a correspondent for about 14 years. So it was overseas all that time. Then I came back. And then when I was back, I realized actually an awful lot of people are writing about things as if women don't exist. They're writing about wars, never quoting women, or if they quote them, they're quoting them as kind of passive, you know, widows, victims, not as people that have an active role in any way. So I became aware that I was like in a minority of people doing that kind of reporting after I'd been doing it for a very long time, if that makes sense. Now things have changed a lot. Now there are loads of women reporters, and in Ukraine, often women reporters seem to be in majority. So that's great, and it's totally different. But when I first started, it certainly wasn't the case. And I do remember one of the particular Afghan Mujahideen commanders, an amazing man called Abdul Haq, who was the Kabul commander, who was sadly killed in 2001. I was really keen to travel with his fighters to Kabul, and he said to me, "But girls don't go to war." And he made me go because I was very insistent. actually go on a sort of training course with some of his fighters. And I happened to be a really good shot because when I was a kid, we used to go to fairgrounds a lot. And I was used to like doing the shooting range. So from that, I somehow learned to shoot. So when I was sent on this course with these Afghan fighters, I turned out to be a much more accurate shot than they were, and they were quite shocked. And so then he agreed that I could go with them. I hasten to add, I have never carried a weapon in any of these, and absolutely against the idea of journalists carrying weapons, or indeed, I don't like traveling with security. But it was useful to convince the very male mujahideens to take a foreign woman with them.
And Sharon, you in your new book, Glowing Still, you sort of cite some previous foreign writers and sort of travel writers who were women, dating all the way back to sort of the Byzantine period.
Indeed, a Jiria who rode a donkey into Jerusalem in the 4th century CE, and we still have her book. But actually, Martha Gellhorn was a great hero of mine, who, of course, is most well known for her war writing. She said, "There is no victory or no defeat, there is only catastrophe." And it was always the war that won. But she wrote widely in other genres as well, for which she's less well known. She wrote 3 novellas and she wrote a lot of travel pieces. And she was a great heroine of mine.
But sadly, don't you think, because there were other women correspondents like Virginia Cowles, who I think is a much better writer, and if you haven't read her work, I really recommend it, that unfortunately the reason we all know about Martha Gellhorn is because she was married to
she was married to Hemingway, but I think she's now coming into her own, and I find I do speak about Gellhorn without bringing him up, which I think is important. And I think she was a good writer, actually, at her best. I think better than Virginia Cowles.
And her, do you?
I think her novella about Africa is probably about East Africa, is probably her best. Anyway, she was a great figure for me. And like, as Christina said, I didn't sort of think about either being a woman or particularly seeking out female role models at the beginning. And then when I came to write this memoir, I sort of thought, well, there sort of weren't any, were there? But then I realised that there had actually been a lot. You just got to look for them. People like Ijiria, who nobody knows anything about, and all kinds of others, not famous people like Martha. And then, of course, in our own time, the generation above me of travel writers as opposed to newsmen, and they were all men. I'm thinking about Paul Theroux and Jonathan Raban and all of that lot. It was quite a testosterone-laden field. And to a certain extent, when I started out, it still was. It was a sort of, I used to call it the I've Got a Big One school of travel writing. And that has seeded ground during my so-called career. It has seeded ground, the I've Got a Big One school, and that is good. And the notion of women writing about places, not perceiving them to be like another mammoth to be clubbed into submission outside the cave. As Daniel said, I wrote a lot about the Antarctic, and there really wasn't anything by women about that place, and women hadn't really been there in any way at all. And that was really the ultimate mammoth outside the cave, and you had to be this, you know, fabulous person with a frozen beard to even survive there. And of course, they didn't like it at all when I wrote about it not being that kind of person. I don't do any sledge pulling or anything like that. I don't have those skills, and nor do I want to have them, as a matter of fact. But so I've seen in my life, in my last decades, that seeded ground, which is good, and I don't think there's really much of an appetite now for that, clubbing it to death like it's another mammoth outside the cave. And I think that sort of hybridization of the travel writing genre, which Gellhorn and other women were sort of pioneers of, really, I think it kind of suits the female way of observing things. And I've seen female travel writing gain ground in the way that the other kind has ceded because of that observation. And there's no question about it that you have tremendous advantages just hanging around. I mean, you know, travel writers, what you do really is you hang around waiting for something to happen. And you have huge advantages as a woman. I mean, I was in Chile for 6 months. Pinochet was no longer head of the government, but he was head of the army. He was still there, like this sort of eminence grise in everybody's head. And I learned more about what it really means to live under a brutal dictatorship around tables, kitchen tables high up in the Andes from women with, you know, a baby in one arm and toddlers in the other. And they wouldn't have invited me in had I been a man, because you can't just go around in any culture at any time inviting strange men into the kitchen. It's not a sensible thing to do. And so I felt I had access. Well, I did have access. And why not take advantage of it? When I came to try and sort of, not sum up, that's too grand, but put all this, these memories together and try and say something about what's happened to travel writing and to travel in the past 4 decades while I've been at it in this book, Glowing Still. So I tried to say what's, you know, look at these notebooks and say what's funny, what's changed. Well, that's everything. We could talk about that later, how travel's changed. And what's important, which is sort of tangentially referring to the really important things that Christina writes about. I thought, well, do women really do this differently? And there was somebody who has been around, was around the whole time I was writing, who was the sort of grand dame when I started, called Dervla Murphy. I expect some of you know her. And I admired her, you know, massively. I miss her. So I told, when I started thinking about doing this memoir, I said, "Yeah, Dervla, you know, I'm thinking about doing this, but do you think that really women do it differently in our game?" And she said, "Oh, well," she said, "I'm not sure." She said, "I mean, sometimes they don't even know if you are a man or a woman." And she said, "I remember I was in Cameroon," and she said, "I'd been traveling with this bloke, he was a kind of guide, for 4 days, when he said to me, 'Are you a man or a woman?'" And I said, "Goodness, Dervla, what did you do?" She said, "I lifted up my T-shirt and showed him my tits."
So, you know, as you, sorry.
I was just going to say that, I had to follow that, but what you were talking about, the access that women have, I think is really important, because as a female journalist, I've spent a lot of my career in the Middle East, so I'm able to go and talk to everybody. A lot of my male colleagues are not able to talk to half the population in much of Afghanistan or much of the places in the Middle East. There, you know, a man can't go and talk to women. And so I think, you know, we have a far better picture of what's going on, because we don't have half the population denied to us. And I don't think I've ever had a man refuse to speak to me, but I think I have. Years ago in Saudi Arabia, it was quite difficult sometimes to have access.
And I think, you know, I mean, sort of, you've just returned from Ukraine, and I wonder if, you know, sort of, I think in cultural terms, there are places like where Afghanistan, where there is a sort of obvious access that women can have that men can't have. But I wonder, when you're reporting in Ukraine, whether there are ways that women approach stories and sort of that people sort of open up naturally in sort of perhaps more open societies.
Yeah, I don't want to generalize too much, but I mean, I think that women are better at listening, so that's very helpful as a journalist. And I think we tend to be more interested in the sort of people story and less in what I would call the bang bang. So I tend to write much more about how war affects people and not so much about the actual fighting. I do a bit of that, but and that's, of course, the most dangerous bit. So if you do the other stuff, it's less dangerous. But, you know, who knows? A friend of mine was just very badly hurt a week ago in that attack on the pizza restaurant. You might have seen shelling in Kramatorsk. And, you know, it was just a crowded pizza restaurant at 7 in the evening, not on the front line. shelled by the Russians. And this is a very good friend who's actually a Ukrainian poet who's currently on life support from going out for a pizza. So you just never know.
Sarah, you mentioned that the nature of travel has changed, and that's sort of something that we've had to get to grips with, particularly the kind of hard stop of the pandemic, where I suppose both of you were suddenly rooted at home, which must have been quite frustrating for you.
Well, just to before we come to the frustration of the pandemic, when I started out 40 years ago, it was morally good to travel. It showed you were interested in other people. That was partly, as I've said, what set me off there. Mm. It was a good thing to do. You weren't a little Englander and all the rest of it. And now you're a big villain if you go anywhere. First of all, hydrocarbons, not going away anytime soon. And in fact, the title of this book, Glowing Still, comes from a seminal environmental book published in 1969. So we knew everything then. Called The Peregrine. I don't know if any of you have read it, by J.A. Baker. And he talks about the planet Earth being like Mars but glowing still. So hydrocarbons, just not going to go anytime soon. Secondly, the pandemic might be over, but the idea of travelling in a metal tube, viruses are not going anywhere either. That's always going to be with us. It's kind of not really a great idea. And thirdly, voice appropriation, which in my field is a huge thing. You know, you're not really allowed to write about anybody else, taking away the stories of the global south that belong to them. Well, where does that leave us? And where are we to go? And then plus the fact that you've got the fact that we've been everywhere. Got that, somebody waving a flag saying, well, we've been everywhere now. We don't need, there's no part of the earth we don't know about. So where does that leave us? But people say travel writing's come to an end because of all those things, but I think it'll always flourish because people will find a way, as they always have. And I do think perhaps it suits a woman's voice not conquering business and of observation. And I'm sorry to say that I had an absolutely lovely time in the pandemic. I mean, it seems terrible to say it when one knows what appalling suffering there was, and I wouldn't want to let that has to be the headlines. But, I basically earn a living reading, which is what you have to do before you can sit down and write. And I had all these notebooks up there, which I said I was absolutely amazed when I read them, how much I'd left out. And I did ask myself, so I got, that's what I did in the pandemic, got them all down, and friable, coming apart in my hands. And I decided that I could see really that I'd left a lot of stuff out when I started out. There were, as I said, there were very few role models, and how did one have the confidence? God knows. But luckily, you don't think about those things when you're 25, do you? You think about them now, though. And I think I left things out because I wanted people to take me seriously. And now I'm 62. All I want is for people not to take me seriously, which I suppose is a sort of arc of something or other. So that's what I did. I got all those books down and I tried to stitch them together into some kind of memoir saying what's happened to travel in that time, what's happened to me in that time, and put in some of the best funny stories, which always seem to involve lavatories in the Antarctic, penguins coming up through ice holes and so on, which I learned that
is a very evocative image.
British readers have an insatiable appetite for. What was important, and what's changed? Those three things, really. What was funny, what's important, and what's changed.
So you don't have any fear that travel writing will sort of has no future?
No, not remotely, no. People will find a way. There'll be just be less flying around, perhaps, which could be a good thing. Less going somewhere just... It's always been a silly idea to go somewhere just because nobody's ever been there. I mean, what sort of reason is that to do anything? And that's now been removed from us. The Antarctic was a different thing, really, because it was this kind of enormous place, 1.5 times the size of the continental United States, which doesn't sustain life. It's extraordinary, and it was unowned. So I was young when I went there, and it's a very potent thing, this unowned land. You know, there's never been any wars there, and never will be. No pollution, no wars, no people. You know, it's this pristine symbol of what the planet could be, and that's what young writers should think about. It was several decades later that I started looking north to the Arctic, because that's the opposite of all those things. The Arctic's a symbol of what the Earth is. Tons of people all been dragged into the cash economy and with same disastrous consequences. I'm talking about indigenous peoples all around the second polar north, of which there are 37 different groups in Russia alone, Russian polar peoples, all dragged into the cash economy. Terrible results, as I say, and degradation, and it's not even defined, the Arctic, where does it start, where does it finish? It's desperately polluted, all these bioaccumulative disruptors that the people at the top of the food chain, you know, PCBs, all the things that we down here have done. It's just a symbol of the terribleness of what planet Earth is. So it's much more suitable territory for a middle-aged writer. I think I was 50 when I wrote my book about the Arctic. And it was those two things. I remember one of my kids said to me when that book was published, "Well, Mum, how do you feel? You know, you spent so much of your life writing about the Arctic and then the Antarctic before it. How do you feel today?" And I said, "I feel very glad there's only two poles." And he said they call Everest a third pole. But I really wish you hadn't said that.
So is that next on your list?
No. Totally not.
And Christina, you wrote a book on some of what you experienced in Shropshire.
In the pandemic, so, of course, the pandemic was very problematic for foreign correspondents because we couldn't travel. So I reinvented myself as a home news correspondent, which I had never reported on my own country since I'd left Birmingham back in 1988. And so, in a way, this was like a foreign country to me. And so I started reporting on the pandemic. I was doing things like kind of frontline on the pandemic, going to intensive care wards and seeing incredible, brave work of the doctors and nurses, but also very much looking at how the pandemic affected people, the human cost of it, and saw very quickly that it was very unequal and that the pandemic was exposing inequalities in our society, but also exacerbating them. And so I was doing things like, I mean, early on, you remember the weather was nice right at the beginning of the pandemic?
Yes,
so
I do remember that.
I was like sitting in our garden, it's a small garden, but we have a garden in South London, and then thinking, what is it like if you're in a tower block and you're like in a really cramped condition? So I spent quite a lot of time in Tower Hamlets in East London and got to know families where there were like four kids of different ages in a two-bedroom flat with no outside space, one sharing one laptop, and, you know, it was just so different. So I was writing about things like that quite a lot. And then it occurred to me, what about homeless people? And the government had this scheme, which was actually a successful government scheme for once, called Everyone In, which was to take all the rough sleepers off the streets by the weekend of the first week of the pandemic. And they looked around for what to do with them and realized that an obvious place to put people up were hotels, because nobody was staying in hotels. So they commandeered all these sort of generally sort of budget hotels. So I wrote about this in London and went and talked to people in budget hotels. And then I met this woman who told me that we met virtually on a Zoom, who told me that she was manager of a hotel in a place called Shrewsbury. And she said that they'd taken in, I think then they'd taken in 37 homeless people, and that she and the owner of the hotel and the accountant had all left their own families and moved into this hotel to look after their homeless guests. So I was really intrigued. And then I Googled this hotel, which is called Prince Rupert Hotel, and was rather astonished because it's not like these other hotels that I'd written about. This is actually a 4-star. It's the most luxurious hotel in Shrewsbury. It's very historic and has 4-poster beds and a Jacobean staircase and sort of a decanter of sherry at the reception. So I was trying to imagine how people who'd been living on the streets for decades then moving into this hotel and how it would all work. So I went and spent a day there to write about it for my paper, the Sunday Times, and I met some of the guests, and I met Charlie, the manager, and Mike, the owner, and Jackie, the accountant, and I was absolutely intrigued. And so then I said to them, how would it be if I also came and moved into the hotel and wrote a book about it? So they agreed. So I moved in. So I spent some of the lockdown living with the homeless people in this hotel, which ended up taking in more than 100 homeless people. And actually, when it came to the end of the first lockdown, and you might remember because it was sort of gradual how things reopened, and hotels were the last thing to reopen, which was in the July. When it came to it, they was so upset at the idea that these homeless people would basically be sort of kicked out that they decided not to reopen the hotel. So they stayed. And then eventually it got to September and it looked like things were starting to be more normal. And a lot of their homeless then had been rehoused. So they only had 25 guests still. So they then reopened and had this weird period where they had regular guests and homeless guests. And the homeless guests were actually a bit annoyed because they'd had the full attention up till then. And then they felt they were sort of being treated as second-class citizens compared to the paying guests. So some of them even posted reviews on TripAdvisor. But others would sort of hang out in the bar, and one of them, Bev, she was a real character, and she said to me that she used to give advice to the paying guests of things to go and see in Shrewsbury. She just used to make up stories of like, oh, Anne Boleyn stayed in this place, or and so they'd go off and see all these things. Then we went into lockdown again. So this hotel, over a period of a year until the end of March of last year, basically was a place for homeless people. And what really intrigued me was that I think we saw during the pandemic how it sort of brought out the best and worst of people, brought out, you know, a lot of compassion, a lot of people volunteering, a lot of, you know, we got to know our neighbours on our street in a way we never had before, and people were helping each other out. And this hotel, these three people, the owner, the manager and the accountant, what was really intriguing to me was they had no interest really in homeless people before. In fact, the owner said to me, he used to walk past homeless people and think, why don't they get a job? Why are they like littering the street? And their views completely changed as a result of this kind of weird year that they had. And they feel that they were the ones that really benefited from the year more than the homeless people. So it was, to me, a really nice story of compassion, but also a way. I tend to write books which are about difficult issues. My previous book was about rape in war, but it was a way of being able to write about homelessness in a much more accessible way, maybe, than if I'd just, you know, gone and sort of talked to academics and gone to shelters and things. Because this way, I actually lived with them, and they couldn't, because we were all in lockdown, they couldn't avoid me. So, of course, some people were wary and didn't want to tell their stories, which is fine, but other people really, really liked having somebody to tell their stories to.
That is fascinating, as is your book. And I'd like to ask you about, you say, Everybody In, which one is so thrilled that one government scheme succeeded.
Well, it succeeded and it
didn't.
But
I want to ask you about now, because now it comes up now a lot in terms of that's all well and good, but now actually all the good has been undone.
Yeah, I mean, what it showed was that if you had the political will and the money, and it didn't actually cost that much money, you could end homelessness. We are, after all, the 5th or 6th most affluent country on earth. We shouldn't really have this huge homeless problem that we have. But where it didn't succeed, I mean, it succeeded in bringing people off the streets, but of course many of these people are challenging individuals. Many people were drug addicts or alcoholics or had suffered abuse. They needed more than a roof over their heads. And I think what was difficult for the hotel, particularly Charlie, the manager, who is an absolute lovely person, she thought, if I cook them really nice food and we look after them and I give them hugs, that will change their lives. And it did make a difference because many of them, you know, hadn't experienced that for a long time. But it wasn't enough. They needed support. They needed counselling. And that was the missing part of the equation. They didn't get that kind of support from the social services, partly because it was locked down and so people were all working from home and they were offered Zoom sessions. They were actually given tablets like iPhones or iPads by the local authorities, which they immediately all sold to buy drugs or different things. But, you know, it was a bit much to expect people who had lived, some of them had lived 30 years on the streets, to actually sign up for Zoom sessions at a particular time and do that, I think.
So one of the sort of main stories that's really come out since, you know, we sort of emerged from the pandemic was the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban once again, which, you know, is a story that you've worked on for many decades. And, you know, we've got a couple of minutes before we take questions from the audience. And I wondered if you just want to, like, reflect on the situation for women there today.
Yeah. So I don't know if anybody was at the session yesterday with two amazing Afghan women, but as I said then, it is to me the most heartbreaking thing I have ever covered. To see, I've gone back three times since the Taliban took over, and to see the Taliban running Afghanistan now after all of that 20 years, all the losses of life, of British lives, NATO lives, Afghan lives, all the money that was spent for absolutely nothing. And, you know, some of my female Afghan friends there say to me, it would have been better if you, the West, had never come because you created dreams which now are shattered. I try not to feel that because I think it is better that millions of people were educated. But, you know, the fact is we are in 2023 and there is a country in the world where girls are banned from going to high school or university. Women cannot work. Women cannot buy SIM cards for phones. Women cannot go to parks. Women cannot go to gyms. It is completely unacceptable. And I have a real fear that while there was a lot of outrage about this at the beginning, it's now almost 2 years. It will be 2 years next month. That it slightly feels that the world has moved on a bit and that we're just kind of accepting it, and we must not accept it. It's not, absolutely not right. So I, as I said yesterday, I will speak at any forum about this because I do not want people to forget, and we owe to those Afghan women and girls the same chances that we have.
Time for questions from the audience, I think. Thank you so much. So who would like to start us off? Any hands, please?
Christina, when you went to Pakistan to start off with, did you go to an office, a press office, or how did you manage? I mean, I suppose everybody says, how did you understand the language? How did you communicate?
So when I started out, to be completely honest, I had no idea what foreign correspondents did or what they needed. And so I just went to Peshawar, and I knew that there were seven different Afghan Mujahideen groups fighting against the Russians, and they all had offices. And I was freelancing. I wasn't working for any particular newspaper or magazine. So I went to every one of those offices and talked to their spokesperson. And actually, I mean, most normal journalists just sort of found out which of those groups were the most effective. I mean, what we were all trying to do was get into Afghanistan with them. So which group was taking journalists, which was easier to go with, going to the most interesting place. I didn't do that. I went to see all of them, which actually turned out to be lucky because the smallest, most insignificant group was run by somebody called Professor Mujahidi, and his spokesman was somebody called Hamid Karzai, who at that point no one had ever heard of. And so we ended up becoming very close friends because he was very excited that a foreign journalist had come to speak to him. And he turned out to be a real Anglophile who loved Cadbury's chocolate and Somerset Maugham stories. And so we have been friends ever since, and never ever imagined then that he was going to be president of Afghanistan. And I think he would have been astonished if somebody had said that to him. So that just shows the sort of, I'm sure as a travel writer, often going to places that you don't think there's any point in going to actually end up being most
interesting. Absolutely. Climb every mountain, yeah. Climb every mountain and make a decision you're going to go somewhere, and then it doesn't really matter if nothing comes of it because it's the journey getting there, and something will come out of it, and if it doesn't, that's fine too. It all goes in. And I do believe everything comes out somewhere in some form or other once it's all macerated and stewed away. I think you have to, because you couldn't make those qualitative decisions. Yeah. Is this going to be worth it? Well, what does worth it mean to a writer?
I always say to young journalists that I always find that the last interview is the most interesting. Rewarding. Just like if you're in a refugee camp, you've been there all day, it's hot, dusty, you've been talking to loads of people, and then you think, I'm going to go. And then it's always that one last person that you decide to speak
that's
to
really
that has the most interesting story. It's funny.
I find often it's the one tiny detail. People often say, oh, I haven't got anything to tell you. And they drone on, and there isn't that much. And there'll be one tiny detail, and it's like splashing a mosaic with water. In my mind, anyway. Suddenly, this one detail, the specificity, which is everything in all writings, isn't it? Specificity can make you see.
Any other questions? Yeah, great. Keep them coming.
So, where's next? Where would you like to go? That, or have you been everywhere, both of you? Or is there anywhere that you aspire to going that maybe you can't go?
Well, I'd really like to go to China, where I've never been, but I feel that it's somewhere that you really need to spend time. There's no point going for sort of a week or 2 weeks, so I've never quite had that time. There are a lot of places as a journalist that it's become difficult to go to because we're not getting visas. So, and we're now in a bad situation with Afghanistan because, so there's a rather bizarre situation where the Afghan embassies from the old government, which doesn't exist, are still operating. So I can get a visa in London from the ambassador of a government that ended 2 years ago. So I can travel to Afghanistan, but so that's how come I've gone 3 times. But the Taliban now have got a bit wise to this and now say that as journalists, we have to have permission from them before we go. And they've been, funnily enough, refusing permission to female journalists. Ooh. So that's very frustrating. And I'm very concerned about it because it's hard enough. I mean, Ukraine, it's very, very important, I believe, that we cover what's happening there. But it has rather sucked all the bandwidth away from other things. We're not covering a lot of other stories in the way that we should. I'm very concerned that we don't forget what's happening in Afghanistan. But if we can't go there, and there's also few journalists now operating there because the Taliban are making it so difficult for journalists within Afghanistan. So that's very difficult. And that's, you know, there are other places too that are making it difficult for us to get visas to go to because they don't want people to know what's going on.
I write about people quite a bit as well, and I'm writing the authorised biography of Jan Morris at the moment. And that's the most foreign land of all.
Do you have any tickets booked? No, for are you going off to Egypt for any research on Jan Morris?
Yes, I must have told you that. You can't have just guessed that. yeah, I'm going to Oman and Egypt.
I've been looking through your inbox to find your emails.
Yeah, I'm going to Oman and Egypt for my next trip. But the truth is, I say I'm going to follow in Jan's footsteps, but I'm not really. The truth is that it's a nice conceit for me to be sitting places where she was. She did quite an epic journey through Oman in 1954, if you can believe that. Talks about Abu Dhabi as a little fishing village. It's nice as a romantic idea for me to think of her being in those places, even though they're all completely unrecognisable. And it gets me out of the archives.
Well, I just came back from Iceland, which isn't my usual. There's no war. In fact, it just came number one as the most peaceful place on Earth in the Peace Index.
But is that why you went?
No. It was kind of weird. The paper asked me to go and interview the Prime Minister, the female Prime Minister, and I was actually in Ukraine, in eastern Ukraine, really, on the front line when they were asking me. So I was contacting our travel office, asking them to book me flights to Reykjavik, and they were rather baffled because they were like, you're in Dnipro and Donetsk. But it's quite hard doing all this, like, quite traumatic conflict stuff the whole time, so I like to balance a bit. You might be aware that a lot of my work, apart from trying to remind people about Afghanistan, I campaign a lot about the enormous epidemic of rape in war. And I mentioned earlier that I'm very fascinated by what happens to women in war and that there's a dark side, and that is the dark side, the use of brutality and sexual violence, which is happening on a massive scale. Seen it recently in Ukraine by Russians, but it's in the detention centers of protesters in Iran, Belarus, the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, and then it's happening in Ethiopia, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in Sudan at the moment, South Sudan. I mean, you're literally talking about tens of thousands of women that's happening to, and occasionally men and boys. And almost nobody's brought to justice. It is the world's most neglected war crime, and accountability is absolutely the exception, not the rule, which is very frustrating. And it seems slightly odd to talk about positives from Ukraine, but if there is one positive, it is that for the first time, we've really seen a lot of reporting on this issue. I mean, back in 2014, 2015, when I was doing quite a lot about what was happening to the Yazidis and the girls in Nigeria that were taken by Boko Haram, my then foreign editor literally said to me, "Nobody wants to read about this." And I was lucky because we had a female editor of the Sunday Times magazine, so she would publish things in the magazine. So that's how I got the stories. So now to see it being written about everywhere is really good. And I hope that is going to bring attention to the issue to help women in all these other places where it's happening.
Yes, madam.
First of all, thank you both for a fascinating discussion. I really enjoyed it. Just wanted to ask you, Christina, that some of the stories that you're covering, in particular, rape as a weapon of war, must have surely an impact on you personally. And I've just recently read the memoir of Fergal Keane and his PTSD problems. How do you cope with that yourself?
I'm not sure if everybody heard. It was about the effects on me or other reporters of reporting these kind of traumatic things. Of course, and I've read Fergal Keane's book, which I found very hard to read because it was a bit too close to home, I think. I mean, for me, however difficult these stories, and that book on War Rape, Our Bodies, Their Battlefields, was by far the hardest book I've written. However hard it was for me to write, it's much harder for the women to tell their stories, and they very bravely did. And of course, you know, to actually go through those terrible experiences. So, but I couldn't write very long on that book, you know, each day. And so I kind of, you know, go and walk in the park, I'd look at trees, go to the theatre, try and do completely different things. But I think what really keeps me going is, although I go to bad places where people are doing bad things, it's sort of where you also find people doing the most remarkable things too, and you come across people, really inspirational people. So I was lucky to work with Malala, for example. I worked with an amazing Syrian refugee called Nujeen from Aleppo, who traveled all the way from Aleppo to Germany during the refugee crisis. And she's one of these people that if you spend an hour with her, you just feel better about life. She has a real gift of happiness, even though she has cerebral palsy, she's in a wheelchair, and she, I mean, if it's hard enough being a refugee crossing a continent where nobody really wanted you, to be a refugee in a wheelchair was way harder. So I've met all these amazing people. In my book, Our Bodies, there's some real heroes. Actually, interestingly, they're men, the heroes in that book, a lot of them. One of my personal absolute heroes is a man called Dennis Mukwege, who runs something called Panzi Hospital in Bukavu in eastern Congo. And his hospital has treated 55,000 women who have been raped and children. When I was there, there was a baby of 6 months that had been raped that was brought in. And that man is phenomenal. He risks his life. He has had several assassination attempts. And he's just absolutely inspirational. So I feel, you know, very lucky that I can go and meet these people. And it gives you somehow a bit of faith in humanity that even in these really bad places, there are people doing amazing things. And sometimes maybe very small things to make a difference. But they are, and Malala says one book, one pen, one girl, one teacher can change the world, and I feel like I've seen that. I've been on the ground, seen how somebody, they might not think that they're making much difference, and Ukraine, very good example of it, the amount of volunteering, you know, everybody is making food to send to the military or making black jackets or raising money to buy drones and night vision glasses. It really is quite incredible, the level of involvement of ordinary people.
Well, let's hope that we don't have to wait another 29 years to put you guys back together. But thank you so much, Sarah and Christina. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to support the festival, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Don't forget to mark your calendars as the Bradford Literature Festival returns for its 10th year from 28th of June to the 7th of July 2024.